Hello, everyone. This is Jerome from the Fundamental Principle. Patrick wasn't able to join us due to some technical difficulties, but with me today is, I think, one of the most important clerics in the world for his work on the truth about the Second World War, Father James Maudsley. Father, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Jerome.
I just have a couple questions for you to start off, and that is, liberalism and Christianity are fundamentally incompatible. I think that that's fairly obvious after the disaster of the last 100 years or so. Could you talk about the nature of the usurious system that we live under being incompatible? And liberalism and usury are the fundamental, non servium, right, is the cry of the liberal. And could you talk about just the nature of the usurious system and liberalism being inherently, well, anti-God? I don't know what the proper term.
Yeah, I mean, the anti-reality, and we see that non serviam in usury because it's trying to get something from nothing, and money without labor, basically. After the fall, God decreed that man and woman would have to do penance, and for man, that's in the sweat of his brow, laboring in the field, to remove thorns. And usury attempts to get wealth and substance, security, in fact, power over others, control, without laboring. It's a rejection of penance, a rejection of that cooperation in our redemption. And its roots go way, way back. The Romans had great problems with Jewish usurers. Then William the Conqueror coming over from Norman France in 1066 to invade England was funded by Jews. And after he'd successfully done the fighting, he brought over Jewish financiers to England who would be rewarded politically, or else Norman nobles would be given, for example, position of sheriff. And they would protect Jewish usurers who came over to England following that. And there'd be a lot of antagonism, hostility with the native English population. And then through the centuries, usury has been a way for the Jews to accumulate wealth, to buy up more and more princes. The Reformation in Germany was very much a power struggle, a political thing, about money and control of localities. And then the usurers discover that they can make so much more money by funding both sides of a conflict.
And there's money, they did that in both world wars. And the Russian Revolution. And, I know you're an English patriot. Correct me if I'm wrong, but weren't the Jews behind both Cromwell and the so-called Glorious Revolution? I know they were behind Churchill.
Cromwell brought the Jews back into England around 1660 after they'd been expelled by Edward I, I think 1190. Some of them had remained there, but they had to keep a low profile, even under Henry VIII. He wanted Jews to underwrite his divorce from Catherine of Aragon by giving theological opinions. So he'd sent like his favorite Hebraicist, Robert Wakefield, to go and consult with the rabbis to get theological arguments from the Old Testament, from Leviticus or Deuteronomy, to support divorce, which of course Christ had forbidden. And others went across Europe, to France, to Venice, to bribe theologians to get these opinions and to consult with the rabbis. So there was this pernicious Jewish influence theologically and financially in England before Oliver Cromwell, but he opened the gates to them. And then we see like the formation of the Bank of England shortly after, and the East India Company, who they weren't founded by Jews, but they were very soon taken over by them. The whole British Empire, also driven by usury and sodomy. It was a money-grabbing operation to strip money from the world. And recently, Jeffrey Sachs came out with a talk saying that behind all the problems in the world is Great Britain, that that's where so many of the unresolved conflicts come from.
Well, it's the city of London. Say
that it's,
yeah.
Yeah, but it's the Jews
right,
behind
course.
That. Well, behind
Jeffrey Sachs
Empire.
Is a Jew, and so he wouldn't be honest about this, but they're the ones.
Yeah, he says a lot of great things, but he'll never tell you the truth about the Jews or about Jesus.
That's right.
And they're the most important things.
Of course. And that's, I mean, they're the war in Ukraine is entirely a Pale of Settlement Jew conflict right now, right?
I certainly think they're behind it.
Well, I mean, Victoria Nuland, her family's from Ukraine. They have a deep ethnic resentment of Ukrainians, of Slavs. And they like it when they die. I mean, that was the motivation behind the Crimean War. It was a motivation behind... you're of an age where... Did you ever watch the wonderful BBC sitcom Yes, Minister as a kid?
Yeah, yeah.
There's a particular scene I'm thinking of where... Prime Minister or Minister Hacker in Department of Education, Sir Humphrey Appleby says to him, you know, England has had the same foreign policy for 500 years, right? We fought with the Dutch against the Spanish and with the Dutch against the French and with the French against the Germans, right? Like, because despite the Protestant errors, most of Europe was pretty Christian until the 20th century. And the Jews who ran England from Cromwell's time, which is in the 1650s, didn't want, and they replaced the king, right? We got a, you know, England got a Catholic king back, and then, mm-hmm. you know, for 30 years they had a Catholic monarch, and then they're like, nope, and then they replaced him with William of Orange, who was just their boy. But
yeah,
the Jews were just afraid of a continental Christian power.
Yeah,
and they did everything they could to, you know, to support it.
Yeah,
and they were pro French Revolution until they weren't, and because the disorder and all that threatened their interests. But you know, you talked about the sterility of it for a second, and a friend of mine once said that USA, you know, stood for usury, sodomy, and abortion. And of course, we're in the middle of June, which is the month of the Sacred Heart, you know, for all sane people. You know, we see this glorification of sodomy, which is, I mean, if you have any doubts that our society has gone to the devil, like, just look around. And Dante in Inferno links, you know, usurers and sodomites because they're sterile. And of course, abortion, right? Like the only reason we have this invasion of the United States and Europe generally with non-Christian third world people is because of all the abortion and contraception that our people have been engaging in since the Lambeth Conference in 1930. And so all the kids that weren't born that should be working have been replaced by foreigners. And, you know, these are all downstream of the non servium that the church attempted to baptize in the Second Vatican Council. If the church had stood firm, in the 20th century and been what Pius X said we should do and Pius IX and, you know, be illiberal, charitable and with holding the great powers to account, but not allowing liberalism, things would have been much, much better. But could you talk about the conceptual link between the sterility of usury and the sexual perversion that we see rampant with the abortion and the sodomy?
So they're both anti-reality, you know, with the usury, this something from nothing, as if you can have an effect without a cause. And the sodomy, it's against nature, against God's creation. There should be a natural sense of revulsion at it. And so we had a healthy situation in schools where if any boy gave any sign of being gay, the other lads would mock him ruthlessly. And in fact, they'd mock anybody, whether they're gay or not, who, you know, on the slightest risk of that. And I don't mean beating people up or making them bleed or anything like that. But I mean the mockery, that the peer pressure that protects people from that, understanding it's disgusting, because some former homosexuals talk about going through the disgust barrier that you have to. And that's why homos are such predators. They pick on young boys and get them through that disgust barrier, and then they might be stuck with it for a long time or for life. The church had a very strange phase. I don't know if she's still in it, but to do with seminarians, when Benedict XVI correctly said that nobody who has strong homosexual tendencies should be ordained to the priesthood. They shouldn't enter seminary. But no one who's practiced homosexuality should enter seminary. But the modernist bishops would say it's a phase in the life of man. Yeah, but even our bishops are saying this, that they've not matured, that they've gone through this phase and they've not got effective maturity. But it's not a phase in the life of a normal male. It doesn't come up at all. So if it has come up and been engaged in, then that man, if he repents, goes to confession, God bless him, and I hope he could overcome any temptation. But the church has lost her way on this. We were talking earlier, I don't know if it's recorded or not, how shaken the church has been by lies about World War II and the Holocaust.
Yes.
Which put the blame on everybody, and as if the world's gone to pot and God's no longer omnipotent and God is even dead. That's right. The ultimate aim of it. And so the church doesn't know what to believe anymore.
Right. Well, inherently, and the late great Bishop Williamson talked about this, and I think you're the only churchman alive who still does correctly diagnose this problem. It must be pretty lonely. There are thousands and thousands of lay people who have it figured out, but very few churchmen seem to be talking about this. The new religion, Golgotha, has been replaced by Auschwitz, right? Even though there are lies surrounding Auschwitz, and the Jews have replaced or lowered their sacrifice, and the tenets of that religion are that anyone who advocates for white people, for Christianity, for Western civilization, for normality, right, or against perversion, they're automatically wrong or suspect, right? And you see it in America, via the transitive property of wearing gray uniforms and being Christians. The Confederates in the United States of America are automatically, the worst evil thing in the history of the world. I don't know. But to admit that, certain that nature is real, that God is real, that certain things are unacceptable, right? That inherently makes you a national socialist, and therefore the worst thing ever. Like Hitler has replaced Satan as the devil figure. Go ahead, Father.
For a long time, because the Jews reject Jesus Christ, the Messiah, they're searching around for a false Messiah, from Bar Kokhba on, trying various different lunatics who either claim to be the Messiah, and they even try and say for a period that King Hezekiah or King David were the promised Messiah, which makes no sense at all, given the datings. And finally, they got this theory that they, the Jewish people, are the Messiah as a whole. And therefore, they think that their suffering is like nobody else's suffering. And they're literally saying now it's their suffering which redeems the world. This is how spiritually deluded they are. And it's inevitable, if you reject Jesus Christ, who's the truth, that you're going to slide into more and more insane darkness. So that is how the idea that there's been no event in history so terrible as the Holocaust, even though it never happened.
Right. More Germans died in the Rhineland camps and the post and the expulsions.
Right.
And of starvation and exposure than Jews died of typhus in the camps.
Yeah. So that's supposed to fill people's minds as the worst possible suffering and what we need to atone for and save ourselves from. So as you correctly say, anyone who criticizes Jews or homosexuals, because the Jews will say how many homos went to the camps as well, is you're immediately labeled a Nazi with the implication that you want to commit genocide. And this is why so many otherwise sensible people lose their minds over that. Once that allegation is made, or they're terrified of being on the receiving end of the allegation, they won't even look into these things. They won't consider it. They won't allow a conversation on it. It's the only thing that could replace the sacrifice of Christ on Calvary in the minds and hearts of people is a massive lie, because the truth is never going to replace that. Again, I don't know if our earlier conversation will be recorded. I don't know if to bother repeating.
Go ahead, please. I mean, it was important what you said, so please.
How it's devastated people's hearts and minds to the point that so many people of different religions have lost their belief and others fallen to despair or suicide is asking themselves various questions like, how could the Nazis do this in a cold bureaucratic way? How could the German people allow it to happen? Surely they knew. You can't hide something like that. Jews would ask themselves, how could the Jewish victims have been in general so passive? How could they let it happen? Filling up the gas chambers without rebelling, that the instances of rebellion seem so few. And then the question after the war, they didn't just blame the Germans, they blamed the whole world, saying, why didn't Roosevelt or Churchill do anything about this? They must have known through intelligence intercepts. Even why didn't the Pius the 12th or the Vatican do more about it? Though Pius the 12th did so much to protect Jews from the expulsions, well, not from gas chambers, but from deportations and from the rumors people had heard of what was happening. But with a massive ingratitude, the Jews say some Jews say he's complicit in this genocide. The church has done this, which is why believing that so many people think that the whole world and the church has to change after World War II, which is why Vatican II, we see the church could get hijacked and it presented as if her teaching has changed. And the ultimate accusation is against God, that he cannot be omnipotent, or he would not have allowed this to happen.
Or benevolent or anything. And, right, of course, you're from Europe and you've traveled all over the world, and, you know, the people of the world are different and they have different virtues and different vices, and some of those are inherent and some of those are, nature. And to acknowledge any of those, right, is, you know, oh, well, you know, they put the gypsies in the camps. So obviously anyone saying, well, you know, this population that commits a lot of crime isn't very bright, doesn't follow the rules, you know, occasionally kidnaps children, right? We shouldn't just let them run rampant and ruin other people. Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. Yeah, well, that's bigotry. So we can't do that. So
right. After World War One, they imposed the Treaty of Versailles to try to destroy Germany. And then they really went for it after World War II, as if to say Germany cannot be trusted to run itself, cannot be trusted with its own sovereignty. That was imposed on all Europe with the European Union, this idea that for the sake of peace, you need to pool your sovereignty, surrender your sovereignty, which is completely against nature and God's created order of the different nations. The you know, your body has, you have one soul, but many organs in the body. And so the soul is like the church giving the truth to the whole world, spiritual concern. But the different organs of the body, which must be distinct with their different functions, are like different nations of the world, which must be politically distinct. Then they can cooperate or work together like the system works. The human race is a family, but you have to have the different identities. And yes, this idea that any patriot or nationalist is thereby automatically hateful of other nations. It's ridiculous, but that's the narrative that's been swallowed.
Something like a quarter or a third of all Albanian men under 30 are in the UK at the moment, and what do they do there? They deal drugs, they get on welfare, they abuse people, they commit crime, and it's not insane for someone who's patriotic Englishman or patriotic Scot to ask, why are these people here? They're not Christians. They're not Englishmen. They're not British. They don't belong here. They need to go home. They need to go home and make Albania better. But they're not.
Right. The Antichrist Jewish globalist plan is melting, destroying all nations. So through usury and debt, they have caused an economic devastation in so many countries of the world. And then through their wars, turning Middle Eastern countries and Muslim countries to rubble, using Britain and America to do much of this, by the way.
Yes.
You then have these waves of immigrants, and that's to destroy our cultures.
Yeah,
and the Jews are laughing because they're destroying. And so I don't know how bishops can be so pro mass immigration when
because
it destroys everyone's culture.
Right. Well, it destroys everyone's culture, but because the bishops are, I mean, fundamentally, right, at least in the United States, you know, most of the bishops are probably perverts.
I mean, why don't they care for the home nations of the immigrants? Because it's the people who travel are the ones who are stronger, younger, able to travel.
Smarter.
When a country loses its young men, it has no chance whatsoever.
Yeah, who's going to do the labor of building and
right.
plowing and like you need your fighting and defending the nation? And of course,
yeah. If you care for developing nations, you want to support their population within their nation so it can grow, be strong,
right?
Make its contribution.
And
by destroying their countries and bringing them over to destroy ours and create divisions among us, so we're meant to fight each other instead of realizing it's the Jews coordinating all this. It's iniquitous that the bishops support this and call it charity. It's not charity.
No, it's not. And of course, you know, like it's a. How would I describe it? Like it's a three card Monty game where, you'd worked in the private sector before becoming a priest. If your district manager or whatever had seen results like what the bishops of the Western world had delivered, you'd have been fired, and like your reputation, whatever private industry you're working in, you'd be blackballed. No one would ever hire you for anything ever again. Like if you mm-hmm. deliver the results, kind of results the bishops deliver. But you know, the bishops of the UK, right, rather than being like, well, you know, we've catastrophically failed and baptisms are down 80%, or you know, marriages, people aren't getting married, people aren't receiving First Communion, you know, 80% of the people in the pews don't actually believe what the church teaches. Only 30% of the people actually who claim to be Catholic only come to the church. I mean, the statistics are pretty grim across the board. But the bishops in the UK will be like, well, we'll just fill the pews with Poles then, right? Mm-hmm. Or in the United States, we'll just fill the pews with Mexicans, and never mind that that's a deleterious effect to Poland or Mexico. That what happens, right, in, you know, a Pole comes to Ireland or comes to the Midlands in the UK, within two generations, his family's just as secular as anyone in it. Like, they've lost the faith too.
Right.
Because the bishops haven't done anything to strengthen the faith. And so the society, like an acid, eats away at the faith of the people who come there with strong faith. And then, you know, there are no processions. There's no public recitations of the rosary. There's no pushback on anything.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's similar with Islam. You know, it doesn't have a magic formula to withstand secularism. So that second, third, fourth generation Muslims have often lost their belief, and so people kind of think Islam is going to take over. I'm not convinced by that, but what I think is all nations are having their identity stripped in the interests of the globalists. And so we need to recover neutral and natural terms like foreigner, or distinguish between immigrant and refugee. Of course you have a duty of charity to the refugee, someone who's fleeing for their safety, who has no option, take them in. But that's very different to an immigrant. And all through history mixed populations where you would have minorities, and that is enriching for any culture, and it's good for communication between nations. But they are minorities and they are guests, so they behave as good guests, or they will be restricted and ejected. And part of this understanding of foreigner is a natural term, it's not an insult to anyone, is that they shouldn't have political power over the home population. No foreigner should. And the Jews are foreigners everywhere. They shouldn't have for 2,000 years their own nation. The state of Israel is an aberration, an abomination. It's a rebellion against God. It's disastrous for mankind that Jews should have this sovereign voice. So if you understand that the foreigner can't have political power or wield undue influence in your country, you have a duty to protect them, make sure they're okay and not maligned, but never give them power. And that's what England needs.
Against, it's against needs. The canons of the church. I think canon 70 of one of the Lateran councils says Jews cannot be in public administration or the law or teach, which, I mean, if you extended that canon to where things are now, right? Like, they shouldn't be allowed in the media, and they own the media. They shouldn't be allowed in Hollywood. They own Hollywood. They shouldn't be allowed in high finance. They own high finance. They shouldn't be allowed in the government. They own the government.
Like, absolutely.
These are not, you know, the Code of Justinian is very clear. Like, these people shouldn't be allowed positions of influence in our society. If you've read Schultz and Neeson's 200 Years Together, they were the ones entirely responsible for the revolutions that led to, you know, tens of millions of deaths. The Warburgs used their control of the city of London to finance Lenin, which led to the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, which of course then led to the Bolshevik, the Maoist Revolution in China, which led to, you know, the domino theory, which led to, you know, revolutions in all over Southeast Asia. And if you don't talk about this in an honest way, right?
Mm-hmm.
People will talk about it in a dishonest way, first of all, or people will just ignore. It's like ignoring stage 4 cancer.
Yeah.
You know, and just like, oh, well, you know, this gigantic, basketball-sized lump in my neck, we're just not talking about it.
Yeah, and that's the Holocaust narrative behind that, the massive lie about this genocidal intent from Germans, one of the most civilized nations on earth, and no one can explain where this is supposed to have come from. Well, they say anti-Semitism is just this irrational thing that erupts and takes people over. But there's always a reason. And at root, it's nearly always Jewish behavior. And that causes a reaction. But if we've been told that there's this mysterious, irrational hatred of Jews that can just come out of nowhere and take over, and that's what happened to the world in the middle of the last century, therefore, we can't trust our systems. And I mentioned before as well, the church has been blamed for this, as if the Gospels are anti-Semitic. The lying Jews say that when the Jews failed to the majority to convert in the time of the apostles, the apostles then grew bitter and resentful and thought they'd failed with the gospel, and they became anti-Semitic, and that's what's come to the scriptures. This is garbage because of the early writing of the scriptures, but the apostles didn't fail. Many Jews did convert, and those that didn't convert, they failed. They're damned for it. The apostles were taught by Jesus to shake the dust from your feet and move on. So St. Paul said, the Lord has sent me now to the Gentiles. I'll go to the world. If you Jews won't hear it, fine. The Jews will have their time at the end of history to convert. But the effect of the Holocaust narrative is that the church has failed, our cultures have failed, Europe has failed. Therefore, we can't trust our forefathers, can't trust tradition, can't trust the church. And so we don't see that these documents like Sicca Judaeus and a dozen popes in the between the 7th and 14th century saying that Jews should not have power, but you need to protect them, but don't allow them to have power over Christians. This is so wise and good. The homilies of St. John Chrysostom are not anti-Semitic. He's saying the Jews are dangerous. They're subversive. We need to hear that and trust him. He's a saint. He's one of the greatest Eastern patriarchs. If we would trust our forefathers, exactly, then we'll be safe from this danger of the Jews, which is causing misery, genocide in Gaza now, like the world's never seen.
50,000 dead children. 50,000 in the last 2 years.
I mean, if we say the Jews have a spiritual problem, that they're antichrist, then we get that conversation gets shut down by people who are supposed to be shepherds of the faithful. The bishops will shut that down, and good little Catholics will jump up and down and say, you're anti-Semitic. They're so terrified of the truth, and children are paying the price dying.
Christian children are, you know, Christian churches are being bombed in Gaza right now. And It was maybe about 10 or 15 years ago now, but I'll never forget it. It's part of what ended up with me here. America, Texas has a senator, Ted Cruz, and he's I think he was baptized Catholic. He's but he's a low church evangelical Zionist Protestant, and he was meeting with a bunch of Middle Eastern Christians from all different Oriental Orthodox, Chaldeans, Maronites, from all over the Middle East, from Syria, from Iraq, from Lebanon. And they said to him, you know, like we are being genocided because of Jews, which is an objectively true statement, right? Like that the Project for a New American Century clean break idea of knocking over all of these strong, functional Middle Eastern countries because they are a threat to Israel. Has, you know, resulted in dead Christian kids. That's that, you know, the end result of American foreign policy is cheap oil for Israel and dead Christians in Iraq, in Syria, in Egypt, in Lebanon, in all of
Egypt. Yeah, and if we tolerate the dead Muslim children, then it will come to us deservedly. If we can accommodate a world where Muslims are suffering mass slaughter and their countries turn to rubble, then we'll go down next, because we shouldn't tolerate even that. Right, and again, it's the Holocaust narrative from which you get this doctrine of preemptive war, so that even Abdel Nasser in Egypt was called the Hitler of the Nile in the 50s as an excuse to go to war with him. And after that, you call Saddam Hussein Hitler. That's the excuse for a preemptive war. Or Assad in Syria, call him Hitler, or call Putin Hitler. Anyone that you want to take out with a strike without any regard for the just war theory,
right,
Hitler is the excuse for it. And it's Hitler was not the man that we're told. He's trying to defend his country from Jews who are absolutely destroying it. He wants to defend Europe from Jews. Yeah. And people just can't even go there with their minds. Roosevelt and Churchill sold out to the Jews, had millions of their people of their countries killed for the sake of Jewish domination and Zionism and the banks.
Yeah, well, and this notion, right, even, so I know you've spent time in Southeast Asia. Japan was a pagan nation. But, you know, the Freemason, Harry Truman, is the one who bombed Nagasaki, which is the heart of Christian Japan. It would have been, you know, the center for evangelization of all of Asia. St. Maximilian Kolbe had a church there. It was miraculously spared from the bomb by a hill that was in the way. But, and then after the war, the emperor asked, "Should I become a Christian? Should Japan become a Christian nation?" And, you know, Freemason Douglas MacArthur said no. So, right, anything European, anything Christian, anything Western, anything strong and proud of our heritage or our history, you know, the glorified Rome or ancient Greece or anything, right, was inherently suspect because that inevitably leads to, well, what are these Jews doing in charge of our society? If we're Romans, if we're Greeks, if we're Spaniards or British people or French people or whatever, why are we being ruled by these foreigners who obviously don't have our best interests in mind, obviously start all these wars? You know,
I think the wars can be a starting point for many people who haven't really looked into this much yet, but I wonder why is it war with Iran being talked up? And then just look at the Iraq war and look at 9/11 and the Jewish fingerprints all over that, and that you have a duty then to the truth and to pursue it. So the evil is revealing itself. You know, for a long time, the Jews weren't very visible in society, but they're lending money, which slowly accumulating that power, which took off with the Rothschilds and Battle of Waterloo and everything. But the more power they've got, the more they show themselves. So the pride marches where you have naked men riding bikes in front of kids, it suddenly becomes very obvious that there's no end. Evil is not going to limit itself.
No.
It has to be limited by Christ and by Christians who decide, okay, enough's enough.
Right.
Enough with the lies. We want Jesus Christ is King. The world is only going to work, or society. I don't want to be naive about we're going to have a perfect peace on earth forever. No, we're not. It's going to be a conflict and a battle. But if we want a Christian order in our society, it has to be Catholic with Christ as King, or the Orthodox come out of schism, reunite with Rome.
Yeah.
But God is allowing evil to really reveal itself. So I think there can be no doubts in the mind of most.
Yes.
Whoever has a shred of honesty, just look at the world now.
Yes, of course. And could you talk about this for just a second? If we're to revive the church, right, the Novus Ordo is a catastrophic failure. It must be rescinded. It must be it must be abrogated, and we must go back to the old mass. But when I was asked to describe the old mass by some friends who were raised kind of Protestant, I described the old mass as inherently counter-Semitic because of the subdeacon covering his eyes as the gospel is read, and the gospel is moved, or the priest moves from the epistle side of the altar to the gospel side. And that mass, the mass kind of forms you as a layperson who's assisting at Holy Mass. That forms you as a person. But could you talk about the necessity of the old mass for the clergy to form them so that they understand these issues in such a way as to actually be able to lead the faithful? Because I think that a huge part of the problem is the new mass is designed to make our clergy weak and effeminate. Obviously there are many other diabolical things it does, but I think one of the, learning more about the altar rails and the destruction of the way that the structure of the mass and everything, right? I think that a huge part of the problem is that celebrating the new mass makes you a worse priest. Could you talk about that, please?
Certainly the traditional mass is so disciplined, and it's such a yoke in that the rubrics control your movements down to a lot of detail, and you have almost no choice about the text you're going to read. But this is good. The man who wants to do service for a great king, and he's happy to bear a yoke, and that forms you in stability. You don't have all these choices and decisions to make about how you're going to do it. And when you're before God, that's good. There's a proper place for arbitrary choices, and it's not the mass. And you'd never have women in the sanctuary in a traditional mass unless exceptionally it's their wedding day or confirmation, and some places they would enter the sanctuary for part of the ceremony. Otherwise, no women in the sanctuary. And the altar rail forms that boundary between the sanctuary and the nave. When you remove the altar rails and have women coming in doing quasi-liturgical roles, whatever, it's destroying the distinction between male and female, also clergy and laity, but ultimately between creator and creature, which is what we're supposed to understand by these differences, the male representing the divine and the female representing the creature. If I could just give an alternative view about the anti-Semitism and with the gospel as well in the form of the mass. We know, of course, anti-Semitism, the word is a nonsense word. It means nothing because the Palestinians are Semites. There's Chaldeans who are Semites. There's certain Ethiopians who are Semites. Who can say you're anti-Semite for supporting Palestinians? The Jews are stealing the identity of all the Semites, pretending they're the only ones that exist or matter because they're afraid to say what it is. It's being anti-Jew. Or that would be a more realistic term for it. And then admitting as well, you don't have anti-anything as the starting point. It's a reaction to something. It's a reaction to Jewish behavior. Anti-Semitic is just a crazy term. But the offertory plate, the subdeacon is representing Judaism there, or the Old Testament. Not that they're the same thing. Judaism is something, a false religion that comes after Christ. Yes. We're warned about it in the Old Testament.
The Israelite and the Jew are two different things.
But it's there, the blindness of the Jews. They can't see the altar. They can't see the gifts. They miss that. But the even in a low mass, you retain the right that the missal is carried from the epistle side to the gospel side for the light, for the truth going to the whole world. And then at the end of the mass, the missal is brought back to the epistle side, which is the Jewish side, which means in the end, after a great apostasy of the nations, the Gentiles, the Jews will convert. They will have again the word of God. And for the same reason, the candles are lit first on the epistle side, then the gospel side. And at the end of Mass, they're put out on the gospel side first and then the epistle side. That's not a rubric. That's just a very good custom. It means the light of God began with the Jews, went over to the world and the nations, but they will lose it, and the Jews retain it in the end, the light, the word of God. So they will convert in the end, and that's good for the priest to see in every single Mass. Stops you falling into hatred. So I hear people saying we need to adopt the tactics of our enemies. We need to do what the Jews do with doxing, with name-calling, you know, and all this hysterical crap. No, we do not need to take on the techniques of our enemies, because then we've lost. We've become like them. Christ overcome through sacrificial charity. That's who we copy, Jesus Christ. And he decides for each of us how much of a sacrifice we have to make. But we certainly do not want to copy the Jews and their tactics, but have this confidence that if we protect them but never let them have power over us, then you will be a saint. And a society will be so strong and clear-headed and clear-hearted that it's not trying to hurt or injure the Jews. It's just saying you will never have power over us because you're Antichrist. We won't accept it. And it's that isn't going to happen tomorrow. Politicians aren't ready. Our bishops aren't ready. But we can all start living like it now. Never platform a Jew. Don't listen to them online. Why would you? They're not going to teach you the truth about Christ. Don't listen to them. And if they start losing their platforms, losing their influence, don't go into debt to them. Avoid at all costs if you can. Do everything you can to avoid debt, because it's just empowering, feeding the dragon. So we can prepare now that it'll be easier for bishops to preach the truth about the Jews and Sicut Judaeus, and that they're not going to be turned on by their flock if they do that. And that will help for politicians to say, yep, we need to remove Jews, first of all, from government and then the banks. Start right at the top and then start bringing down the beam until life becomes tolerable again. As in media, they shouldn't own the biggest of media operations, although you can't overnight remove them from the smallest. But don't worry about the small ones. You know, don't worry so much about the local level. Start with the national level, the big positions, and then bring that down. You want the Jews to be able to have a certain autonomy in their own communities and to be unhindered from their version of worship, whatever they're going to do in the synagogue, as long as it's not breaking the law, as long as it's not criminal. But they shouldn't have influence over Christians, because it's going to be an antichrist influence. And the serpent is so subtle in his lies. See how Eve was tripped and then Adam. We're not better than Adam and Eve. We will fall for subtle lies as well, unless we keep ourselves fixed on Christ and don't let the serpent speak to us. Don't let his words come into our ears. So,
a dear friend of mine once said that the first step is seceding in your mind. You know, once you know about these things, you have to reject them. And I mean, you've talked about your personal journey elsewhere. I mean, if you want to recapitulate that, we can. But I think the most important step for people, and you've talked about this, is you know, getting out of debt, and which is a difficult thing to do in these days, especially with all the high prices and inflation and everything else. Like, if you have a family, you're being pressed on every side.
Yeah.
But could you talk about the necessity of the old Mass and the return to that, if you would, please? Because I don't think it's possible to regain what we can without the old Mass and the old sacraments.
Absolutely. Yeah, one way of avoiding debt, by the way, is not going to university or not sending your kids there unless they are specifically have a calling to study a certain subject or are so interested in that subject and want to excel in it or do engineering or something where you need to go study. Otherwise, university is a place where you are indebted to be brainwashed. You're paying to be brainwashed and probably sexually corrupted. That's what university does to most people. It's, you know, all these good institutions that the church gave the world, like hospitals, universities, the Jew sees anything that succeeds and wants to take it over to extract money from it. So hospitals now are not places where you get healthy. They're places where you get made sick by drugs for the sake of big pharma for money and through government paying, in England at least, for a lot of these drugs and medical care. Hospitals have been, they don't serve health. They serve big business. Yeah, schools America, do not been, serve truth.
Yeah, they've universities have been brought by private equity firms to bring to press the poor and sick like a wine press, and universities right. have similar.
Yeah, you learn lies and get indebted and corrupted by them. And defense is no longer about defense; it's about preemptive attack. At least from the most powerful nations. So whatever, there's a danger of throwing all this away because we see it's corrupted. But it's the interest of mammon, of money, of the bankers, so many of them Jews, that is corrupting them. So that's what we need to call an end to. And you're right, the traditional mass, without that, it's not going to happen. The nations are different, and you will see the genius of our Creator in each nation when it is worshipping him through traditional liturgy. That's what raises up our culture. And I've done a few videos explaining why the pre-55 Holy Week is so important. It's not just it's prayer for the Jews, which talks about the veil on their hearts, their spiritual blindness, that they're in darkness and that they're perfidious. We need to hear all that. But it's an example of how detailed these prayers are. So in Matins yesterday, there's an exposition from the fathers on Jesus' parable about the servants receiving a different amounts of talents. So St. Gregory the Great is telling us that the more you've received, the more will be required of you. Therefore, strive to be humble in God's service. So white supremacists, for example, if you think that you're people, your race is the greatest on whatever metric you're going to work that. Personally, I think a system is a better way to think of it than a hierarchy, like the way the organs of the body cooperate rather than just a linear hierarchy. But if you consider yourself so great, admit that you've received that as a heritage from your forefathers and from God. That's where your strengths have come from. You have to use it in God's service, in the service of all, without losing your identity or national identity. Protect that, of course, but it's not so that you can dominate other people or other nations in the way that the pagans want to and the Jews do. It's domination in the Lord, whose dominus is through a service and self-sacrifice. The traditional liturgy is full of this, and that's why people wanted it gone after World War II, and Jews started lobbying for that in fact in the 1920s, failed. Then after World War II, they succeeded in the 40s and 50s to get the Good Friday liturgy and Holy Week changed. And then with Vatican II, they had such a long list of changes they wanted made. And it would have been impossible. You know, it'd be obvious that the Jews are now running the liturgy. So instead, the whole thing was changed. So it's completely mutilated, with the new mass having Talmudic phrases brought into the offertory and the old Gallican offertory prayers being thrown out. But by the way, I don't think we should abrogate the Novus Ordo, because again, that's taking on the tactics of our enemy. I just think the Pope could do three things. One, he could say no one has a right to restrict the traditional mass, including the pre-55 missal. No one on no politician, no prelate, no pope can restrict this. I don't mean like you can have an interdict, perhaps, but that's always for a spiritual good. That no priest needs permission to say the old mass, not from his bishop, not from anyone. It's his job to do that. And so that what there you free up the old mass. Second, the Pope could celebrate it, and that will cause many, many people to want to, many priests to want to say it, and many faithful suddenly trust, oh, here's a great good that they're curious about, they want to explore. And third, you could mandate it for the seminaries. So each seminary has to provide the old mass every day for the seminarians. If the perhaps some of them go to the Novus Ordo, but they must be able to go to the old mass. And I think within a few years, no one will want to go to the Novus Ordo in the seminary. No one will want to be ordained in it. And it means that over the next 5 or 20 or 30 years, there's less and less priests saying the Novus Ordo, but there's less and less people who want to go to it. And we don't take it off them the way they tried to take the traditional mass off us and give them that cause for shrieking and saying that we're tyrants. But let it be proven that the old mass draws and raises people. It makes so much sense. We absolutely need it.
Or the old baptisms, you know.
Yeah.
So, I think Father, you're in your 50s, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So I'm in my mid 40s, and somewhere between when I was born and say someone 10 years younger than me, baptism no longer became a normative thing. But between when you and I were born, most children in the West got baptized. Today, I don't think that's true.
Mm-hmm.
And the old mass with its exorcisms and its, or the old baptism with its exorcisms and its more thorough, more complete driving out of the devils. I personally think that there was a 1,000 years or more where every baby born in Christendom was born within the hearing of a church bell.
Mm-hmm.
And though those sacramentals drive out demons, and they claim that territory for Christ every time the bell rings, that bell rings and that tells everyone within hearing that this where you are belongs to Christ.
Mm-hmm.
The lack of baptisms, the promotion of drugs, which of course the Sassoon family, the Sackler family here in the United States, the drugs are Jewish. I mean, they just are, because it supports their banking system. And but there are people possessed. There are people demonically oppressed who've been by their lack of baptism, by the widespread use of hard drugs, they've opened themselves up to bad, malign, demonic influences. And when you, not just the old mass, of course, which is the keystone of our faith, but all the old sacraments must be brought back.
Mm-hmm.
We must, you and of course, we, if you believe in demons, and I do, if you believe in devils, if you believe that, as the first epistle of Petrine epistle says, you're like, the devil roams about the world seeking the ruin of souls like a lion, right? Like, if you believe that, then of course you must defend against them. And in the old rite of marriage was more serious.
Yeah.
All of these, the old confirmation with the with this that you were a soldier now, like every single one of the sacraments.
Yeah, and the office
is right and fit to a world where devils are real. You will, hell is real. People go there, and most people, and I can't take seriously anyone who doesn't see the crisis for what it is. I mean, it's as bad as the Arian crisis. I think it's the worst crisis in the history of the church right now.
Yeah, certainly. The you're asking about the advantages of the old rite in the formation of a priest. I'll try and give a couple of examples. I think basically, because the old rite grew up over centuries, I mean, it had millennia of preparation in God's hands, and then it fulfills all those Old Testament sacrifices which were fulfilled in Jesus' sacrifice on Calvary. But the old mass is Jesus' sacrifice on Calvary, given to us now in a sacramental manner rather than its violent and bloody manner. And it's grown up from so many millions of people's input and testing it until it perfects its form. It's like the difference, the old and the new mass, is like the difference between letting kids explore and play in some woods or in a playground. That the children will never grow tired of the woods. It's endlessly fascinating. On the big picture of the trees or whatever, or the tiny details of what's under a leaf on the floor. Whereas a playground, it has a few, you know, a roundabout, a slide, a seesaw, whatever, and you soon work out the whole thing and you can get bored of it. But some of those details in the old mass, today's the vigil of Pentecost. So the color of vestments is red. And just over a week ago, it was the vigil of the Ascension and the color of the vestments was white. Now, normally for vigils, it's going to be violet and it has a penitential character. There'll be a tract in the mass. It can be a day of fasting before the great feast, which comes the day after the vigil. But for the Ascension and Pentecost, you have the white and the red vestments. And it's just like this immediately obvious sign to even an illiterate peasant who comes there. This is not a day of penance and fasting, this vigil. And it's because it's in Eastertide. Between Easter and Pentecost, it's not appropriate to go in for a major fast. And then all through Lent, I saw a very interesting article on the New Liturgical Movement saying that the communion prayer in the Mass from Ash Wednesday is from Psalm 1. And then through the days of Lent, you go through the Psalms pretty much in sequence, Psalm 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. There is anomalies with the Thursdays and Saturdays were back in the 7th, 8th century when this was had been adopted by then. There were liturgical days, and there's a couple of other anomalies. But you get the sequence of the Psalms, and this is important for two reasons. One is it shows us back in the 7th, 8th century what Psalms 9, 10, 11 were and how the Mass followed it. Unfortunately, since Vatican II, the Catholic Church has gone the Protestant way, and they Talmudist's way of renumbering the Psalms in a way that's against all Catholic tradition, against the Vulgate, against even the Septuagint, and that the church fathers would who had this original psalm numbering. You St. Augustine speaks of the 72nd psalm, or Cassiodorus of the 112th. So you can see we have in the Vulgate the same numbering they used, and that fits with the divisions in the Septuagint, which is older than the church. It was like 200 years before the Septuagint was translated from the Hebrew. Somewhere after that, the Jews decided to have a different psalm numbering. And it doesn't make sense where they've split them. I won't get into it, but these acrostic psalms that they've split doesn't make sense. Now, why? It's obvious why the Protestants followed the Jewish canon and threw out seven books from the Bible. But why are Catholics now following the Jewish numbering of the Psalms? It's one step away from thinking they know the Bible better and following awful Jewish exegesis of the Old Testament, never mind the New.
Right.
And well, my point is that the Old Mass, you're unlikely to spot this yourself even in 50 years with the Psalm sequence. But when a scholar points it out and you notice it, it's like the endless detail in the Old Mass which keeps our faith secure, which wards off Jewish error. And it humbles you. You realize this mass is huge. The detail in it is huge. And it touches so much of our life. It's the highest reality on earth. It can form the whole culture.
Sure. I last year, I chanced to be at a Novus Ordo ordination, and I saw on video the Fraternal Society of St. Peter ordinations this year.
Mm-hmm.
And it's night and day.
Yeah.
It's night and day.
Yeah.
And I've been fortunate to, you know, do pro-life stuff in most of the states of the Northwest and gotten to know reasonably well on a first-name basis with, you know, several dozen Novus Ordo priests. And what you see is that the I don't want to say that they're not interested in doing their job, because that's not true, but the the stakes are lower, right? Mm-hmm. They're not like when the children at Fatima said that Our Lady told them that souls were falling into hell like snowflakes in a blizzard. If you've ever been in a real blizzard, you know that that's a terrifying thought. Mm-hmm. But when, you know, the religious life, as the old ordination shows you, right? Like, you're going into combat, you're a soldier, you might die. It's going to be, you know, sun up to sundown, hard work all the time. You know, be prepared for spiritual combat. You know, demons are going to be after you. You must offer the mass, and this, you know, you must be a soldier on parade ground, you know, with neatness and seriousness with the old mass. And you must go through the rigor of hearing confessions and understanding human beings and all of these different verses. Then I don't want to say that they're not, that, you know, the Novus Ordo ordination isn't valid, because that's not true, but it's just much less.
Yes. So what I was saying,
the reality
about
of what's being presented is much less apparent by the rite itself.
Right. With the psalm sequence through Lent, for example, in the communion prayer, I did check a Novus Ordo missal online, wondering how they did it. Ash Wednesday, they got Psalm 1, but after that, it's just chaotic. You can't see any pattern to it. It's basically, Martin Mosbach, as it wrote a book about the heresy of formlessness. The new mass has less form than the old mass, distinctly less form. And it's every agent acts to impart its form, so that whatever species of an animal, it wants to produce children which are going to have its form, its nature. The heat of something is form. A hot thing will pass its heat on to any adjacent objects which can receive heat. God has shared his image and likeness with man, with his creatures, so that we're capable of receiving his life, which, in a manner of speaking, although it goes off the scale with God, it's a form that he's giving to us. And because the traditional mass, you know, it wasn't just decided by the Pope or by bishops how the mass is going to be. Very often there's customs which would arise in different nations, and that they would catch on because they're good and holy, and then eventually come to the notice of Rome and be approved. Like, the creed wasn't said in the masses in Rome until the 11th century, I think. And one of the popes responded to someone from France or Germany who'd come to Rome to tell the Pope, we have the creed in our mass. And the Pope said something like, yeah, well, we don't need it in Rome because we're not going to lose the faith. I can't remember. But basically, there's this process where things come up from the hearts of the faithful, from the practice of a parish, then a diocese, then multiple dioceses, and then Rome approves it. And after 15 centuries, the mass is perfect. And anything that seemed like a good idea, and that you try to insert it and it turned out to be impractical or to break the rhythm of the mass or to be incongruous with the whole, fell by the wayside. What we end up with is something that has been shaped not only by millions of souls, but by countless saints, by the authority of the church approving it, and with the roots going all the way back through the prophets and Moses, who in the instructions for the tabernacle that Moses received, which is all to do with the body of Christ, and the priesthood of Aaron, and before that, we have all this input into the mass. And truly, it connects you with the Garden of Eden, the whole thing of the tree of life, which is the cross, and Jesus is the fruit, his body is the fruit hanging on the cross, which he gives us to eat. So in Eden, it was, do not eat this fruit, but since the Last Supper, Jesus said, take and eat. And he's giving you that fruit from Calvary. And Our Lady under the cross undid the folly and fall of Eve, while Jesus recapitulated not only Adam, but the whole universe in his death and resurrection. So if without the old mass, you're cut off from Eden. I've said this elsewhere, but the first man to die was Abel, and his sacrifice as the good shepherd offering a lamb. It turns out Jesus is that good shepherd, and Jesus is the Lamb of God, both. So when you're at Mass, we have this prayer honoring Abel and his sacrifice. It's connecting you with all generations and the very purpose of creation. And it lifts you up. And when people say, oh, it's in Latin, I don't understand it, that is so to miss the point. If the mystery is so high, it's going to take a lot of meditation and work to begin to understand what means the death of God on the cross.
No one can fully understand it.
Exactly.
Padre Pio say, if we fully understood, no, John Vianney said that if we fully understood the Mass, we would die. I can't remember which saint said that, but one of them. And, you know, even a small child, like a 6 or 7 year old child who's not even ready for First Communion yet, can sing and understand the propers in Mass. You know, and they'll sing with full gusto and with joy in their heart, and it's wonderful to watch. And to your point about these things were incorporated and baptized, my favorite, and I don't know if this is true or not, but this is what I heard many years ago. At the end of the Rosary, right? O Clement, O Sweet, O Loving Virgin Mary, right? I believe it was St. Bernard of Clairvaux who added that.
He may have done, yeah.
But like, here's this, you know, this saint and a genius who's a doctor of the church, right? And everyone else, like, understood that he'd been given this gift of this understanding that was appropriate.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The only thing that I would say, I mean, you've done far more work on the pre-55. I think the only good thing that you can say is that adding St. Joseph to the canon was, I think, a good thing. But
no, disaster. Disaster. I'll explain why in a second. I just say, I heard that the person who wrote the Salve Regina, I think, was a monk called Herman the Cripple. Maybe it was St. Bernard who added those words at the end. I might be wrong about this. But he was a crippled monk, and his brother monks would carry him out on a warm day to lie him in the meadow so he could enjoy the sun, and then leave him there when the rain broke and run off laughing. How terrible is that from your brother monks? But this Herman the Cripple was a saint, and he composed this beautiful prayer. He suffered in his life. He suffered from his brothers, but he's bequeathed that to us. Again, I might be wrong on the facts, but about St. Joseph. St. Joseph, the shadow of the Father, the man chosen to take the role of the human father of Jesus to fulfill that, all except the biological part. He's so humble. I might have this wrong, but I think there's not a word from him in Scripture. We don't hear a direct speech from him. I know that's true of Lazarus. I think it might be with St. Joseph as well, Joseph. So the canon of the Mass is offered to God the Father right from the beginning. Te igitur, that te is you, God, Father. And the canon of the Mass speaks of your Son, Jesus Christ. So it's addressing the Father. And it the whole canon, and it finishes with the Our Father as a bookend on the end. So St. Joseph, in his humility and the church in our understanding, didn't want anything to distract from the fact that the canon is offered to God the Father, and he's the true Father of Jesus Christ. So St. Joseph isn't mentioned there. So there's no confusion that although he's, you know, an immeasurably great saint, he's purposely left out of the canon that's incongruous. Why would St. Joseph be left out of the canon where 40 saints are named and all the apostles and the Virgin Mary? Well, it's to make clear that the canon is offered to the Father so that when the priest says it in a low voice that no one can hear, and he's saying it facing the tabernacle, what people incorrectly say, oh, he's got his back to us, or he's saying it in Latin and they say that's not the language. Well, he's not talking to you. He's addressing God the Father. So the fact that he's in a low voice, the canon pretty much silent, and it's in Latin, and that he's not facing the faithful, all this helps us understand it's for the Father, and that helps us understand why St. Joseph isn't there, or his absence helps us understand that. Who's the true Father of Jesus? And if we understand that the body and blood are being offered to God the Father, there'll be less of this idiotic line from people when they say what they like in liturgy and how they think the liturgy should be. Why are people giving their opinions? Who cares what you think it should be or what you like? Of course, you should love the whole liturgy, and you can talk about what you love in particular, but not like they're your preferences for how you would like it to be. This is something given to us that we receive. You don't say when you're buying someone a gift for their birthday, you buy them something that you know that you love. You're trying to give them something that they will love. So the Mass, we're giving to God what he loves, not how I want it to be. That's the meaning of offering Christ first to God the Father before he's received in the sacrament by the priest and before received by the faithful. The Mass is first for God, as everything we do has to be first for God. And then it makes the sense that when we do things for other people, for our neighbor, for our enemy, for whoever. So that's why putting St. Joseph's name in the canon, I think it happened in 1962, I think John the 23rd. And after that, everything can happen, right? You can pull the whole Mass apart. There should have been the attitude, we will not touch the canon. We will not change anything. And we will not mutilate the missal or the calendar. And I think St. Joseph has the humility to handle it that way.
I you make a compelling case. I don't know. I'm humble enough, or I try to be humble enough to just let our priests and bishops, you know, handle this sort of thing. I think that one of the reasons so many people have, I mean, there's been a great Saint Andre Bisset, right? Like a great devotion to Saint Joseph, which is laudable and good. You know, he was, and we live in a world where fatherhood, you know, temporal fatherhood is so lacking these days. You know, so many young men, you know, particularly men in their, you know, 30s and 40s, they just didn't have a dad. They were raised by single mothers. They were, or their dad was, you know, married to, quote unquote, married to someone else, and they split their time, and so there's this hunger for fatherhood. I'm sure you've seen it in your priesthood, mm-hmm. That is. Ultimately, you know, ultimately that fatherhood has to be rested in God.
Yeah.
And that's the hard thing for people to understand. It's like, you have to lean on God the Father, and he will lead you to people like St. Joseph or, other saints that will serve as examples to you. And I think that more than anything, our society is sick,
mm-hmm.
because, you know, steals the phrase from Schultz, and he's like, we have forgotten God, right? Like the Christ is King, and mm-hmm. as, they have uncrowned him by Archbishop Lefebvre, right? Like that's the heart of the problem, is that, you know, in 1910, at the funeral of King Edward the Peacemaker, you know, the 1911 Britannica had just been published, and the whole world, aside from revolutionary France and revolutionary America, was effectively under the sovereignty of anointed Christian kings. And there had been this immense material progress, and the world was at peace. And even in France and the United States, there were movements towards rejecting the errors of liberalism and returning to the fold of Holy Mother Church. Mm-hmm. There were still faithful people in France, as Archbishop Lefebvre shows, in 1910. There was that faithful remnant, and there were faithful people in the United States. There were faithful people in the UK, like Manning
mm-hmm.
and Newman and others, right? There were faithful Christian people in every European nation, and that they were in charge of the whole world. And that was broken because we uncrowned Christ the King, and that led to the fall of all of our monarchies and the destruction of the 20th century and to where we are now, where we have, you know, sins a cry to heaven for vengeance being, you know, publicly celebrated in our streets. He was uncrowned because we refused to talk about the Jews, because the Jews tried to the Jews are the one who uncrowned Christ with their control of usury and control of governments and control of the media.
Yep, they uncrowned him in our societies, but interestingly, they actually crowned and enthroned him in the crucifixion by putting the crown of thorns on him, or instigating that the Romans did that and raising him on the cross, which is his throne. And on top of the cross, it's declared Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews, but he's the King of the Kings, he's King of the world. So even they didn't understand that by their evil and their machinations, they've actually served God's plan for the redemption of the world. And it's somehow the same now through the last 100 years of history, when things are coming more and more to light, what's being hidden is being revealed, and evil is getting its chance to show its true colors because it's accumulated this power, and it's showing us what it's really like. All the things they've accused the church of and the Catholic monarchs of and accused of this tyranny, they are the worst tyrants, and they're disgusting the way they want to have the world ordered. So I should clarify, I should have said this earlier on, perhaps, that I talk about this stuff because I'm suspended. I mean, I deliberately got myself suspended because I realized I can't talk about the Jews in a normal ministry, because straight away your superior bishop is going to tell you, shut up, or you've got to have no public ministry. So I'm, because of COVID and traditionalist custodes, it's complicated with that, but I'm suspended so I can talk about it. And I think the church needs to listen, like you're talking about the fatherhood. No father can disdain his child who has a persistent point. And if there's a growing number of children who, I'm thinking of basically nationalists and white nationalists who I realize your audience are very much interested in that. And for decades, the church and the bishops are just treating them as written off, as racists, as if this is sinful. But a lot of them are coming from very good points with historical analysis or natural philosophy. And it's not out of any hatred of other races, but it's a deep instinct. We need to preserve and love our culture own being.
How can you honor the fourth commandment?
Right.
By wanting to destroy. Birmingham is no longer an English city.
Right. You know, heaven is the patria, our homeland, but that connects with our home on earth, our nations on earth. And so there has to be a proper reverence and love for that's been handed down through the generations. Well, and to throw it away, and those who want to defend it, to call them racist, that's where a lot of these strong men aren't coming to church, because they think it's run by old ladies.
Well, it is. It is run by old ladies.
It is. So we need to, but that's all the more reason to be there and to be vocal and charitable, you know? I don't mean gobbing off in the church, but I mean in conversations with other Catholics and with priests and with prelates, and show the strength, the manliness that can assert its point and not take it back no matter how much crap is thrown at you for it. And you're not going to win every argument, or it's going to be a slow process. But be there at the church. Seek out the traditional mass. Seek out the pre-55 Holy Week if possible. And that let that be the organizing principle of your life. And it will become so for our country, because mammon is going down, that the usury inherently must collapse because it has to expand its debt process in order to live. It's a Ponzi scheme.
Right.
Revelations 18.
When you've got to have loans for pizza, like Klarna, and people.
Yeah.
It's yeah.
Got maybe to collapse.
A loan for a house or a loan for a car, something large, capital good like that. That makes sense. And
the timing of it with the collapse is the same as sodomy, because it's fruitless. They need to come after your children to recruit for that whole perverse movement. That's why they're trying to get into the schools and they have their drag queen story hours. There's almost nothing on earth so abominable as a drag queen story hour in a kindergarten, apart from transgender mutilation of children or clerical sexual abuse of children. These are the worst things on the planet, as well as maybe a satanic mass, but they're all of the same dark spirit. I just mean the homobiological collapse comes with, I think, the banking collapse and the cultural collapse and the Zionist collapse. All that collapse together, and you need to be already strong in faith to stand when everything around us turns to dust, because people will lose the heart, they'll lose their minds. And the men will have to stand, the fathers. So let the church, the fathers now, the bishops, start listening to the nationalists, even the white nationalists, even white supremacists, to write them off as racist. And therefore you won't listen to them.
And that's the thing that isn't told. I mean, this is. Some people would call me a white supremacist, I guess, but are Africans less intelligent than Europeans? Yes. Are Europeans slightly less intelligent than Asians? Yes. Are certain populations more prone to violence than other populations? Yes. Or
again, now, if I may go back to that, why I talk about a system rather than a hierarchy, or maybe there is a hierarchy, I don't know, but every nation, every people has their bit to contribute, who God will perfect through the church, through the traditional liturgy. But you're right to talk about those differences. There's a way of talking about it. There's a way of handling it. But to simply shut down the voices is disastrous. And these bishops who talk about being so tolerant and open to everything, and yet they're writing off millions of people without listening to them, without trusting that. One analogy I have is, in an atom, you have a strong and weak nuclear force. And you have these forces that prevent neutrons and protons coming too close together, and forces which prevent them drifting apart. They're kept in a certain tension and place. So the different nations have to keep their identity, not mixing, not being dissolved in each other, but also not drifting apart, so that then they're not connected. And I think the voices of the white nationalists, or more extreme white supremacists, they are like one of these forces that prevent the dissolving of the different identities, and they're crying out really loud. And whether they've got everything, I don't think they've got everything right, but the bishops should listen to them and realize to lose identity is against nature, against God's plan. It's a Jewish plan.
It is a Jewish plan, and I've been doing dissident nationalist media for a long time now, and I know people in Ireland and the UK and South Africa, like anywhere in the English speaking world, Australia, New Zealand. I've interacted with people from all over the English speaking world, and I haven't met a white supremacist.
Mm-hmm.
I've met people who are realistic about race and honest about it, but I've never met anybody. You know, if a Boer thinks that his nation belongs, that South Africa is his nation, and it is, and that it should belong to the Boers, is that a white supremacist, or is that someone who just understands that the Boers deserve their own home, and that they've been there for 400 years, and that the Africans who came there or came after the Boers had made it a prosperous place and brought the gospel and, in their own Calvinist and wrong way. If you lie about something as obvious as the fact that Birmingham was better when it was English as opposed to now when it's Muslim, and there's trash everywhere all over Birmingham, and then when you try and tell people that it's okay for them to be replaced in their own home and for someone else to move into their living room and kick their mother out of her bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
When you try and tell them about Christ, they're just going to write you off. And that's what's happening all over the world. It's why you see a resurgence of tradition amongst nationalist young men, because they understand that the Novus Ordo is a failure, and that they're lying to them about the necessity of maintaining their nations or having families or whatever. So you've lost credibility. The first thing Pope Leo should do is rehabilitate people like yourself or Archbishop Vigano, who were just telling the truth, right? I mean, COVID was...
And we need the conversation, right? Because none of us can come up with the truth alone. We need the conversation.
Right.
So where rational conversations are being shut down,
right?
The devil's at work, because he don't want to be found out.
Exactly. And if I applaud you for your bravery, for being willing to be suspended, I was able to get Easter Mass during the shutdown because of heroic traditional priests. But when the bishops of the world said collectively, our job is not important, but the porno store and the liquor store are,
Yeah.
And then millions of souls just said, okay, we believe you, and stopped going to mass. Yeah. Like that should frighten you very deeply as a bishop. Like, you're going to go to hell for that.
There's so much wrong with those years. It'd be a whole different podcast to get into that.
Well, and maybe it's some of the time we can. But I
hope so. Yeah.
But the reason that, you know, this show exists is our Lord himself said, I am the truth. Mm-hmm. Capital truth. Like, both capitals. The truth.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if somehow God in his providence has seen fit to make the sons of Japheth and the sons of Shem and the sons of Ham different in their own ways, who am I to tell God he was wrong?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. I mean, the arrogance of that, right? Of this modernist, you know, I'm completely wrong about everything religious. I've apostatized. I've become a pervert. But God was wrong about human beings or men and women or anything. Galatians 3:28, people who say, there's no neither Jew nor Greek, so race doesn't exist. Well, okay, well then if necessarily, right, if you believe that, then necessarily transgenderism is okay. And because there's neither male nor female, right? So obviously, you know, transsexual bishops are okay because,
Yeah, I think because they're trying to undermine the truths given to us right in the beginning
right.
of the scriptures of Genesis. It indicates to as they're getting close to the foundations, the enemy, maybe we're coming close to the end.
I don't know. Paul, it's been a fascinating conversation. Are you still on Rumble? Do you have an active channel there? Where can people find your work and support you in your brave ministry of telling the truth?
I have my Holocaust narrative series of videos up on Rumble. The channel is called Scripture and Tradition, Father JM. It was from YouTube with a lot more videos on Scripture and Tradition, but I got nuked there. And it's just the Holocaust narrative is where it's all going. I've got two or three more videos to do there. But it shows why the Holocaust story is fake. What actually happened was forced expulsions. And of course, people died on the way, died in the camps. There was a lot of disease. But there was no genocidal program. So Holocaust is a fake word because it's not a whole burnt offering. It wasn't offering. It's not to God. It wasn't whole, not burnt. The genocide is wrong because even legally, you need to have a systematic plan from the high command. And that never happened.
Yeah, there's a genocide against white people in Europe right now. There's a systematic plan by the EU, by the Freemasons, by the Jews to destroy white nations and destroy white people.
Yeah, they want to destroy all people. So, I mean, that's one of the places people can get. I have written 6 books in the last 3 years. The second one's called Crushing Satan's Head. And it shows how in the Old Testament, there's all this prefiguration of the globalist attempt to literally, although this was thousands of years ago, take over the then known world by crushing different nations and crushing their religions and trying to get them to worship some idol, and is where Mammon is ultimately heading, that spiritless materialism. And it's going to fail. It's going to fail. And Our Lady crushes Satan's head. So finally, if people can either see my stuff on Rumble or on X, if you search for Father James Maudsley, or on Amazon, some of my books. We've talked about a lot of dark issues, a lot of evil. It's going to have such a good ending. Like, and the ending is not simply going to be our victory over our enemies, but you're going to see the Jews are going to convert and, as it were, betray the Antichrist. As Jesus was betrayed by Judas, the Jews are going to turn around. And that they know the Antichrist because he's going to be one of them. They know his plans and preparations. They're going to expose it. Nobody lose heart. Nobody lose heart. If the fight is getting tough, it just means it's coming to the crunch. And we can really look forward to it if we're standing in the faith that tradition gives us.
Amen. Would you give the listeners a blessing real quick, Father, before we close?
Actually, Jerome, you know, the only person to give a blessing electronically online, as it were, is the Pope, but with the Urbi and Orbi blessing. In Pius XII, I think it was said, yes, this can be transmitted by radio when Marconi was helping to set up a radio. A blessing cannot work at a distance electronically. Same way you can't hear confession over the telephone. But I know a lot of priests do this, but I think, you know, you can't do that with a blessing. And even I'm not sure with the praying on a recording, because it's like when it's being replayed, it's not like the prayer's being said in again. So better here to pray in private, like is the occasion to pray in private, sometimes public. So forgive me if I don't, but God bless you. I'll certainly say a prayer for you and Patrick and for all your listeners. And I hope that in the future we can do another podcast.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Father. And if that's the, we want to do, it is not enough to believe what the church teaches. You must also teach what the church believes. And that's sometimes hard. And
get another priest who might give a better opinion than mine.
But no. I think you're probably right. And I applaud you for all of your, I have to say this. It was priests like yourself during the worst of the COVID. There were a few people who stood firm against it that saved my faith, because I could not reconcile the Church of Christ with shutting down the Mass, taking away the sacraments from little children, and
right.
and God's Church. And so when you and a few others, I don't need to necessarily mention here, but made it apparent that this was not of God, and they're like, okay, then I can, and I know millions of other people just left, left. They stopped going to Mass. They stopped going to church. They stopped believing in God, whatever you want to say. It is a vitally important thing, what you were doing, to be a priest and to stand up for the whole truth of God. I want to thank you and applaud you for that. So thank you very much, Father.
All right. God, thank you, Jerome. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you.